Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hi and welcome along to this week's instalment of the Left on Red podcast. It's the day after our very disappointing 2-2 draw against Crystal Palace. Hopefully this episode can cheer you up a little bit.
Okay, well, that was a little bit shit, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit rubbish.
Just another, I said this in my piece as well. One rocky game against Brighton, fine, let that slide. Two in a row, one being at home to Palace.
I mean, Brighton are a good team.
Yeah.
They were better than us, and I know we disagree a little bit, but I don't think Palace were better than us. I thought for 70 minutes, 65 minutes, we were the better team. You were saying that there was a period in the first half where they had more control, which is true, sort of the last 25 minutes of the first half. But I thought on the whole, it wasn't one where you reflected after the game and thought, no, we were lucky to get a point. Like we thought after Brighton,
we were so lucky to get a point, no?
No, because it was two individual errors that cost us.
Yeah.
Not that we created loads, but at 1-0 up, we should have been able to see the game out. They didn't create anything.
Usually we're a bit of a different team after we go ahead, and there was just absolutely no spark after we went 1-0 up.
No, I think Arteta said it after the game, actually. I listened to his interview. And
he did an Arsene Wenger, didn't he?
In what sense?
Put the handbrake on.
He did say that, yeah.
That's what Arsene always used to do.
Yeah, he did, absolutely. But Mikel was suggesting that for some reason the team decided to, as you said, take the handbrake off and just decide they had something to defend.
Not take it off, put it on.
Put it on, that's the one, yeah. No, but they decided that for some reason, after going 1-0 up, maybe it was because of the lack of creativity throughout the match, they thought, we've got this lead without really being able to create anything, let's just sit on it.
Yeah.
But it was the wrong choice.
We spent most of the time before the game sort of winding around Holloway Road and Market Road.
Yeah, going through Camden and listening to him just... I played for Lowell's cousin, sort of...
Called the Mosquitoes, if you ever want to come and watch us.
Skeets for short, Monday evenings, Market Road, be there.
Yeah. so Harry's filling in at the moment as I still haven't been able to play since May. We spent most of the time before the game.
Just sitting around on a human forest bike.
Awful weather.
Terrible, yeah. No, it was actually quite nice to play in though.
Yeah, it's nice to play in.
Not
nice to watch the football
on your own.
Also, the whenever it's raining, the roof above us and the stadium's broken.
In the West End?
Yeah, okay. So it just sort of leaks through.
Don't have those problems in the North Bank.
It just drips right onto you.
Yeah.
So that's not ideal.
That created a bit of a sort of a rush of energy before the match.
Yeah, the ball was actually holding up quite a little bit in the pitch, I thought.
Well, our match or the Arsenal?
The Arsenal.
Okay,
the Arsenal.
Sorry.
It was holding up in our
match. No, the ball was extremely heavy at Market Road for some reason.
Yeah.
It was a first versus second clash and we drew 0-0. It was quite a scrappy game.
Good result though.
Yeah, we take the point.
We usually actually quite like playing on Monday nights, though. We'd won, under Arteta, we'd won 7 of 7
really?
Before that game.
I didn't realise that. I always think, was it a Monday night or a Friday night when we opened the league season and we beat Leicester 4-3?
Friday.
That was a Friday. Okay, we like those sort of Monday Fridays then.
Yeah, that was good that.
Yeah.
But those were the glory days under Arsene.
Yeah.
Weirdly, there seemed to be quite a lot of new people at the game. I don't know whether you...
In and around our regular seats.
Yeah, I don't know whether you had that, but usually sort of when it's the League Cup games or whatever, you have quite a lot of new people around that. But like when I was going into the turnstile, loads of people that didn't know how to use the little scanner.
Yeah.
And then all around us, sort of people that I didn't really recognise.
I got that as well. There were a few people sitting around me that I'd never seen before, which was a bit strange because usually Premier League games, it's always the same people sitting around you.
Yeah.
And you kind of get to know how they're going to react throughout the match and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was interesting for our match day experiences.
Well, we had a bloke behind us that Fat Harry brought. Fat Harry quite often brings his... It's usually sort of his comedy double act that he just plucks out from outside the ground and brings them in when he has a spare ticket. This guy was just so annoying. It was really annoying. He... One I remember Odegaard gave away a free kick towards the end of the first half.
Right.
On the edge of the box. And he shouted, Odegaard, you've got a lot of answers to be questioned if this goes in. And he stopped halfway through because he thought,
Did he get that wrong?
No, he's got that wrong.
Okay, fair enough.
And he stopped halfway through because he thought, oh, I've got this wrong. And he's just carried on. And then also in the second half, he just kept shouting, this game is crying out for Gabriel Martinelli.
When it probably wasn't.
No.
I mean, he did come on and... I mean, he always injects a bit of energy, but definitely wasn't crying out for him.
No, nor would I sit in the stands shouting, this game is crying out for Martinelli at any point.
No.
Strange, man.
Sitting around me, I was sitting next to this guy who was, I've never sat next to him before. He was a nervous wreck. So any time any player got the ball in any tight situation or anyone tried anything sort of technical, as in like not just lumping it long or a sideways pass... You go, ooh, and then when it came off, he'd go, fucking incredible, you. Like, it just made no sense to me. The man had no composure. I would have been worried if he was playing in our midfield.
Well, to be fair, neither did any of our players, really.
No, yeah, he sort of reflected the state of playing.
Well, maybe they got it off him.
Yeah.
Could hear him.
Yeah.
His nerves carried over. Yeah. Oh, we were really bad.
We can only hope that Friday night against Villa is a little bit better.
I was so looking forward to this week as well before.
So was I, because the results elsewhere went so well for
us. They went really well for us. And we could have been sat in fourth place.
On Friday evening.
Going into the weekend. But now it looks like it might be a little bit of a longer week.
Absolutely. I mean, you said in your article that this makes Villa a must-win game. I was saying to you, I think it already was a must-win game. And actually, when you look at this section of games upcoming, this now makes the Leicester away a must-win. Because when you look at it, you think the two home games must-win, and then if you can nick a point away at Leicester, acceptable. But now it puts a bit more pressure on, not just the Villa game, which already had that pressure, but also at the King Power.
It just puts pressure on sort of the next four or five, really. When you fail to get 3 points at home to a team that are mid-table, I mean, to be honest, are we anything better than a mid-table team at the moment?
No, but we should be. We will end up finishing in the top six, if we're honest. But I think it'll be a slog, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe top seven. Top six, top seven.
Oh, I don't have the emotional energy for a slog.
I think seventh and downwards you start categorising as mid-table.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Okay, so we're going to move on to Harry's tactical section for the day. And just to mention, Harry's been sort of fretting for the last half an hour about how annoying his tactics section is going to be.
Well, I was just thinking, actually, the first time we haven't won, but then we didn't win against Brighton. I just think, performance-wise and results-wise, it's sometimes a slog to even bother thinking about why things went wrong from like a... not professional, but a tactical point of view, rather than
something so frustrating as yesterday.
But there's loads and loads to dissect,
like
more than usual, because we changed formation so many times, and also Vieira's tactics were very strange, but also to some degree effective. So it's quite an interesting discussion, I hope. Hopefully not too boring or annoying. So Arteta reverted, but he's now got this second system, which is not too dissimilar from our normal system. We saw it away at Burnley, where it's some fans will call it a 4-1-4-1, I'll call it a 4-3-3. It's actually somewhere in between a 4-2-3-1 and 4-3-3.
It's like it's a 4-3-3 when we haven't got the ball, and then 4-1-4-1 going forward.
Yeah, exactly. So Odegaard is on the left eight, and Smith Rowe's the right eight, but then Odegaard drops a lot deeper and Smith Rowe stays a lot higher, but he's not a 10 because he's just staying in that right pocket. So it's a bit, that's why I said it's a bit of a hybrid between 4-2-3-1, 4-3-3 when we're trying to build out and when we have possession and whatnot. So that was the way things tended to go when we were trying to play out from the back and also through the middle third.
I hated that in the first half, the system we were playing. I just thought we had four, then Partey, and then essentially two right wingers and two left wingers and a striker.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't, usually there's more sort, much more dropping in from Smith Rowe and from Odegaard.
Yeah.
And I thought they were just both really wide and occupied very similar positions to Pepe and Saka.
You thought?
Which just left us with a hole in the middle.
I agree with the Smith Rowe and Pepe operating similar positions. I thought Odegaard was a lot deeper.
I just didn't think we had any, like, there was space in the midfield. Like my dad was saying, that it was just Partey operating the green strip down the middle.
Yeah.
And there was no other Arsenal player coming in to pick up.
Yeah, on the left side there wasn't, because Odegaard was a bit deeper, which I'm saying was, it was a bit slanted.
Yeah.
And then Smith Rowe was higher, but then wasn't coming to receive as much as we like. And maybe that's because he's not so used to playing in the right channel of midfield.
Yeah.
He's more so used to playing left wing and cutting in our system.
To be honest, I do prefer him coming in off the left, I think.
In the other system, which we did go to in the second half, whether that was because of Saka's injury or because of the last 20 minutes of the first half, them having a bit more control than us. But no, we pressed in a 4-4-2, which we always do. So it was Smith Rowe and Aubameyang with two strikers, Pepe right midfield, Saka left midfield.
We tried to press.
Okay, we tried to press. And then I thought it was quite interesting. Sometimes Pepe would become the second striker and Emile Smith Rowe become the right midfielder in that 4-4-2 press.
Yeah.
Which I thought may have been that rotation. There was quite a lot of rotation between Pepe and Smith Rowe. Even when we were trying to play with the ball in our possession phase, sometimes Pepe became the inside right channel. He's more of a right forward, like you see Mohamed Salah play, where that inside channel's used for more of a goal threat than a creative threat, and then you had Smith Rowe out wide. Maybe Arteta's trying to see if he can use Smith Rowe's qualities in similar fashions to, I don't know, how De Bruyne is used in that sort of quarterback region where he can whip in crosses and stuff like that. So there was rotation there, which I thought was interesting, we hadn't seen before. And the other thing I wanted to note was, so we usually, when we're in the final third, transition, so we go to three at the back and then Tierney bombs on as a left winger and then the other winger, so Pepe would be holding the whip from the right, and then you have these inside, the left wing would cut in usually, which would be Smith Rowe, but because Saka's not so much a midfielder, it was more so Tierney and Saka were working in the same space, and then Odegaard was sitting
was
in the two, so the 3-2-5 we usually play was kind of like a three, just Partey, so like a 3-1-6, but it was kind of five because two players were operating that outside left channel.
Yeah.
So it was a bit industrious. There wasn't much creativity. Not industrious. That's not the right word I've used.
I don't think that even is a word.
It is a word. Like, if you're industrious in the midfield, isn't it like gritty? Anyway, I've definitely used it in the wrong context. We were a bit lacklustre, I thought, on the left side. There was one time where there was a nice triangular combination where Odegaard played a nice chip into Saka.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it was pretty stale and I thought it didn't work. And the balance didn't work very well. And then Arteta changed it in the second half.
He did. We were sort of saying at half time that given the sort of last 25 minutes of that half and Palace's dominance and the way the game looked to be going, we were sort of saying to each other at half time that we couldn't come out like this in the second half. And whether it was a tactical switch or just because of Saka's injury?
Well, I didn't realise Saka was injured. I was convinced that bang, straight away, tactical switch, because we were fine in the first two thirds as we usually are, and we just didn't have any creativity.
But he looked to be mobile enough towards the end of that half.
Yeah.
So I guess
my
maybe
opinion
it
tells
part...
me it was partly tactical, partly injury. Maybe it was just two things combined and we thought we'll go for a different option. So we went to our normal 4-2-3-1 with Smith on the left cutting in to play midfield and Odegaard starting as a number 10 and then, you know, going into the right channel and then Tierney and Pepe really out wide and Aubameyang up top and then Lokonga and Partey sitting in front of the three defenders. So it was much more of our normal system, which I thought we played better in.
I still thought
we didn't create very much.
First 10 minutes of the second half we weren't really any good and
I
bet that's when Benteke scored from Partey being a Muppet again. But I think sort of after that, in the 4-2-3-1, we managed to wrestle back a bit of momentum from I don't think we would have been able to get back if we'd have been in the system that we were in the first half.
I agree. That's where I think the difference was. I thought in both systems, in both halves, we were okay in the first two thirds with all the sort of playing through whatever when we were in control.
Yeah.
And we lacked creativity in both systems, but in the second half, going back to our more frequent 4-2-3-1 system, that you could feel momentum building
yeah.
in terms of quality of decision making and stuff like yeah. that. I think briefly just want to touch on what Palace did. So they played multiple systems as well. Quite interesting, there were some similarities. So they sort of defended in a 4-3-3 with, and their midfield was quite key. Conor Gallagher was sort of the key to all of their different.
He's a very good player.
He's very intelligent. So in the midfield, it was Milivojevic as a six, and then MacArthur and Gallagher either side.
Yeah.
And then whenever they pressed, MacArthur and Milivojevic became a double pivot, and yeah. Gallagher had a free role to press as a number yeah. 10. And then when they had the ball in our half, because I was saying before the match to you that I thought it was very strange to start with three strikers up top. But actually, Jordan Ayew was playing as a right wing back, and then their right back.
Well, they were playing a 4-4-2 essentially. No,
no,
they were playing Ayew as a right midfielder. What's his name?
No, what I saw. I mean, this is only my opinion. Was that when they were attacking, so they had the ball like in our half.
Yeah,
Ayew became a right wing back. Mitchell became a left wing back. Joel Ward joined the back three with Gaye and right. Anderson. And then,
yeah, I suppose that it then, probably worked out like that.
MacArthur and Milivojevic sat in front, and then you had Edouard like who came off the left,
on paper.
And then Benteke up top, and then Gallagher sort of had a free roll where he could either join those front two as a front three, so Edouard sort of left, Benteke central, Gallagher right, yeah. or those two, Edouard and Benteke, would become strikers, and Gallagher would again become a 10, yeah. roam wherever he wanted. So it was very flexible.
They really have some good players, Palace.
They do.
I actually very much enjoy watching their side at the moment.
Well, I didn't think they created much, but I thought it was very interesting the way that Vieira definitely had a blueprint of how he wanted
his
team to do things yeah. in different moments of the match.
I think some of his signings have been very shrewd. I mean, Edouard is clearly a brilliant player.
I agree, and I think Gaye from Chelsea, was it?
Yeah.
I thought he's an excellent signing. Yeah. They got him on loan or a permanent?
No idea.
But he's a good player. Also, Elise, young player from Reading that they signed.
Yeah.
Fantastically technical player. I don't know how he's going to integrate into the first team, but yeah. he made good decisions. He didn't come on trying to be fancy when he came on.
I thought that as well. I was thinking a bit of a sort of strange substitution, but he just kept the ball, and when he had a decent enough chance, he'd go for a little run.
Well, I was quite impressed because I played against him, and I know from experience that he's extremely skillful. And I thought, why would you bring on a really technical, skillful young player with 10 minutes to go?
Yeah.
Actually, did everything perfect.
Yeah, he
just defended, got the ball, passed it.
Yeah, I was saying to you actually, I think that in my opinion, I think that for Palace that was probably 2 points dropped when you look at how the game had gone. And I think that the Palace mates that I had that were at the game sort of held the same opinion. But I think part of what did that was Vieira switching to a back five.
At the end?
At the end, bringing off Edouard for Tompkins. I just thought that invited more pressure
yeah.
than needed to happen. I mean, we didn't really have any guile going forward,
like clear cut yeah. chances created through,
and also guile, we weren't yeah. like the crowd were pretty silent in the last like 5 minutes until yeah. the sort of added time went up.
Well, until Lacazette came on and made the roar.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. They didn't need to go to a back five. It backfired because
they could have held the ball.
They could have held the ball for the whole time, but had more
yeah, yeah.
2 minute passages, for example. I don't know if I agree with the fact that it's 2 points dropped for them, but I also think it's 2 points dropped for us because.
Oh, it's obviously points dropped for us, but the way the game went is...
The way the game went, game. I just think the fact that their goals came through our mistakes make
yeah, that
it
2 points
dropped for us as
that
well.
That was the frustration.
Just finally, before we move on, this is where I felt a little bit frustrated with Arteta, was that he then changed the system a second time, so that we played a third blueprint, a third system, and he decided to take Partey off for Martinelli, which was fine, they're going gung-ho, but he changed it to a 4-2-4. So just two midfielders,
yeah.
big gap, and then four attackers, and you know Pepe, Obalaka,
and no one
Gabby.
Really knew what they were.
The tactic
to
was just to lump it up top, and actually, yeah. Gabriel, big centre back, went up top for a bit as well
yeah,
when they
yeah.
put five at the back because Arteta must have said, right, it's a man less, we
yeah.
can commit a man more. We've just sort of played the ball out wide, put it in the box and hoped for the best, which you could argue worked because of the nature of the goal, but I think that came from a set piece, second phase of a set piece.
Yeah,
so that argument kind of goes out the window. If I'm honest, it worried me a little bit because it reminded me of the Emery days where he changed formations often. I mean, I agreed with the halftime change formation, but as we were saying earlier, I think that created a momentum that probably would have created some sort of chance if we'd stuck with it.
Yeah, I just think when we switched to a 4-2-4, it sort of... We just looked like we didn't really know what we were meant to be doing.
It lost all of that sort of structure and momentum that we'd began to slowly regain in that second half. If you look at the possession statistics, we had most of all second half. First 20 minutes of the first half, it was okay. And then we struggled in the last 20 minutes of the first half.
And to be fair, if you look at the expected goals as well...
Which
we were miles ahead of them.
Really?
Yeah, I can't...
That means fuck all, but I mean, it doesn't indicate sort of...
I might.
It does indicate that it's 2 points dropped for us if you know.
Yeah.
It's more so their expected goals where their actual goals have come from dreadful individual errors. Two of them.
The expected goals were Arsenal 1.94, Crystal Palace 0.42.
Well, that's because both their goals came from errors.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough of sort of a tactical rant / discussion. We hope that it was sort of insightful because, I mean, there's definitely things that people might disagree on. For example, like what Palace did, that's just what I saw live. But if I was to watch it back, it may be different.
Okay, so it's time for this week's instalment of player ratings. We've decided to sort of streamline this a little bit, conscious that we might have been talking a bit too much about players that just had very average games. So instead, I'm going to ask Harry for his top three and bottom three players for Arsenal.
Sure.
So, top three?
Number one, in order, Lacazette. I thought he changed the game. I thought we're so much more creative and intentful. I thought Ramsdale was superb with his playing out from the back. It's the best we've seen him doing at that. I know maybe he's questioning the first goal, or the second goal, was it? One that went off the bar. Yeah. And I'm struggling to pick a third here.
So Laka 1, Ramsdale 2.
Ben White 3. I thought he played out from the back okay. I'm struggling to give a third.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there is a third, which is a worry when I give a substitution goalkeeper in my top three.
Yeah. I'd say Laka 1... I'd go Smith Rowe too. I always think he's one of our best players whenever he plays. And then I'd maybe go Pepe 3. I thought he had quite a decent game.
Really?
Yeah.
I was considering putting him in my bottom three.
Really?
I just thought he was a bit indecisive.
Yeah, I guess, but he always is. Yeah, he always is.
He's not in my bottom three.
Okay.
Not sure I can give you an order for my bottom three, but
okay, just
Tierney, Aubameyang, and Partey.
Although Partey
made one mistake and the rest of the game was okay.
I think I'd go Tomiyasu.
Okay.
Gabriel, I thought he was really poor defensively.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought he was really at fault for that Benteke goal as well.
Okay.
And I would go maybe Tierney as well.
Okay.
I thought Aubameyang wasn't great, but I didn't think he was one of our worst players.
What was the point of him being there? can you give me an answer to that?
Yeah, not really.
There you go.
No, I never can. And then I think we should also do we should start doing player of the match for the opposition.
For the opposition?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very good question. I think I'd give it to Conor Gallagher. Maybe he didn't have as many standout moments where he did amazing things.
Mm.
But just from sort of linking back to the tactical section of this episode, I think that he was very key in everything they did and the way they adjusted to different phases of the game. And I thought without him, they wouldn't have restrained us so well, because they did. We really struggled to create, and I thought that he was sort of key in knowing, in orchestrating their press and orchestrating getting back into the system when they sat back, and also creating a few chances here and there.
Yeah,
I think Benteke was all right as well.
Yeah, I think I'd probably give it to Edouard, to be honest.
Edouard, yeah.
I thought he was, I thought when he got the ball, he beat Tomiyasu quite a lot.
He combined quite nicely with Mitchell down the left, actually.
Yeah.
No, I back that.
And then just a quick mention for Mike Dean, who is a prick.
Absolutely. Just class as always. He's so bad, isn't he?
No excuses, but nailed on red.
I mean, we were saying he should have been
on two yellows beforehand.
Yeah, two yellows before
the inconsistency where he's no, he's swiped Smith Rowe. Saka's done exactly the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Saka should have been given a yellow card because it was a yellow card, but God knows why he didn't give him a card.
But MacArthur had done two before of those that.
He identical tackles.
Side Saka on the halfway line, then side Smith Rowe, and then just kick Saka.
Yeah, which was also a red. So he should have had a double yellow, and then he should have had a straight red.
Yeah.
So that actually broke up momentum of the game. Probably didn't break up momentum of the game in our favour as it should have done.
Yeah. Anyway,
Mikel Arteta.
Oh, 3-4.
I'm gonna give him a 4.
I thought we were 4.
Yeah. I maybe would have given him a 5 if we'd drawn and he hadn't changed it a third time. I thought it just caused panic.
Yeah.
4, pretty average, below average.
Okay, so we're on to our second instalment of this new segment. I don't know, we should have a name for it actually.
We should do Old Player History. No, that doesn't have a ring.
Oh, that's good. That is brilliant, Harry.
What, Old Player History? Yeah, taking a mic?
Yeah, yeah, taking a piss. But anyway, okay, so this week...
Why don't we just call it our history section?
Yeah, all right. Yeah, fine.
Historical flashbacks.
No.
No?
No. I'm not happy with any of these.
Well, you seemed all right with the second one.
No.
Okay.
So this week we're going right back. Well, when I say we're, I'm going right back to Alex James. So he played for Arsenal between 1929 and 1937.
Okay, sure.
He was actually a suggestion by my dad, who knew he had a bit of a funny story.
Was he American?
Alex James.
Yeah.
No, he was born in Scotland.
Okay.
Basically, he was a bit of a weird man, Alex James. So he played 8 times for Scotland, but he played 231 times for Arsenal.
Okay. Sure.
He scored 26 goals in that time.
Sure.
But he had a rheumatism, which was like a rheumatic disorder, which is a sort of a condition that affects the joints and causes pain in them.
Fair enough.
So basically he was known for wearing really, really baggy shorts to cover up the long johns that he put on for warmth. And it became sort of his thing, his baggy clothes.
The Alex James style.
Yeah, exactly. He was born in Scotland and he was at a school called the Bells Hill Academy, where he met and became very good friends with Hughie Gallagher, who was also a footballer. He played 624 games and he scored 463 goals.
For a school?
No, this is professionally.
Okay, sure.
So they became really good friends there.
What position was he?
Up front.
Okay.
So Alex James joined Raith Rovers in 1922, and he made nearly 100 appearances, but the main part of his story of Raith Rovers was he was involved in a shipwreck in 1923. When the team's boat that was bound for the Canary Islands struck rocks in a storm.
Right.
I do not think that there were any deaths.
So they all survived the shipwreck?
I think they all survived the shipwreck.
Blimey.
But yeah, so he was in a shipwreck, which is always fun.
I thought you were going to go down sort of like a 12 night route there and say like some of them got split up on an island and some of them...
Yeah. just bear in mind, we've just come off the back of doing 12th night for A-level, so...
Yeah, sorry about that, guys.
That's why Harry's mentioned it. So he went from Raith after his shipwreck to Preston. He signed for Preston for £3,000.
Massive. That's £3,000 in
1925.
That's a massive amount of money, isn't it?
I don't think so.
Is it not? For 1925?
I don't know. Anyway, so he was at Preston, but he fell out with the club, firstly over his wages, the Football League had a maximum of £8 a week.
Is that something you think we should bring back? Salary caps?
I don't really know. Maybe.
Because, in theory, yes, but then if it was to halt sort of the whole system that's in play with television rights and whatnot, maybe the quality of football would go down. It's just a vicious circle, isn't it?
So yeah, so £8 a week, but then he also fell out with them because Preston wouldn't release him for international duty.
Right.
With Scotland.
Hence the lack of Scotland caps.
Yeah. So he left Preston, joined Arsenal for £8,750 in 1929. And but in order to circumvent the maximum wage rules, Arsenal had arranged it so that his employment at the club was supplemented by a £250 a year sports demonstrator job at Selfridges.
Okay, so he actually had to go to Selfridges for a certain time. What do you reckon? He just got like his brother to go or something like that.
I don't know whether he actually had to work there or that was just put into his contract.
I think it makes it more interesting. It makes it less fraudulent if he's actually done it and more interesting, I guess, in the story.
So he in his first season he won Arsenal's first major trophy. In 1930.
Was that the league?
No, FA Cup.
So our first league title was 31 then?
I think so.
Okay.
He scored the first in a 2-0 win over Huddersfield in the FA Cup.
By the way, at the time, Huddersfield won 3 titles in a row or something like that, so it was a big, big deal.
Yeah. And then, so in 1932, he missed the FA Cup final against Newcastle.
Okay.
He was past fit, and then he
just didn't fancy it.
He injured himself in a pre-match photo call. He fell going to these benches that they were taking pictures on, and he missed that cup final, and we lost 2-1 to Newcastle in 1932.
The butterfly effect in full force there.
Exactly.
Potentially.
So during World War II, I think this might have been during his Arsenal playing time.
Sure.
Oh no, it wouldn't have been. Sorry, he left Arsenal in 1937. But during World War II, he served in the Royal Artillery. And after the war, he became a journalist, as well as running like a football pools competition.
What does that mean?
It was like a betting pool based on the football games next week. So, yeah, I just thought Alex James was a bit of an interesting man.
Very interesting man. I think his interests sort of spread a lot wider than the one we did last week.
Yeah. And also, just to mention, he's credited with scoring an additional goal for Scotland. So he played 8 times. It says he scored 3.
Sure.
But they think he might have scored 4. This was in 1929, Scotland beat Ireland 7-3. And of course, because there were no cameras, there's
very
never...
Very easy to lose records.
There's never any way to
maybe
know.
Maybe it was one of those sort of corners where somebody's headed it and it might have whispered off somebody else's head as it's gone in type.
So it says here that Scotland's 6th goal, so Hughie Gallagher, his best mate, who had already scored 4 times before, and Alex James went for the ball at the same point, but there had to be some correspondence between Queen of the South and the Scottish Football Museum in 2016.
Okay.
To talk about whose goal this was.
Whose goal this was, okay.
And the Scottish Football Museum favoured Gallagher, and they said that Hughie himself was insistent that the goal was his, claiming that as he and Alex were of a similar build, it was easy for pressmen to make a mistake.
This seems a bit of favouritism here.
Yeah, but James remains credited with the goal in some sources.
Reminds you a bit of the Harry Kane goal when a few years ago.
Oh yeah, that he claimed against Stoke.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's Alex James for you.
Ah, interesting fella. So, I'm back on quiz duty here.
After disgracing himself last time.
Right, I've tried to find a good balance where there's a easier question, a more medium question, and a harder question, all of which I can potentially give a clue in. Just so that I'm a bit fairer than I was before.
Can you just openly admit that your quiz last time was a disgrace?
Listen, we can shake hands right now. I can apologise.
Thank you.
I overstepped the line, but we found it at least. Sometimes it has to happen. Right, the first question is...
This is a new start section. To the quiz.
Yeah, Lowell won the first section, 5-4, I think.
Which I received a drink at Nando's for, so...
There you go.
That's nice.
First question will be, how many years in a row have Arsenal drawn at home to Palace?
Oh, God.
My clue will be, just think about Unai Emery.
Okay.
And absolutely mucking up top 4. That should actually help you quite easily.
So,
Including this game, yeah. Okay, so this year, last year. I'm gonna go for that.
Okay. Question two. Besides from Patrick Vieira, can you name any four other players to have played for both AC Milan and Inter Milan? Now, I've gone for four. You might think that's quite a high number, but there are so many players that played for both.
Okay. Let me have a think. Oh, God.
How many are you on?
Two, but one of them's very dodgy.
Okay. You're going to kill yourself if you don't get this. Because really? I've got a list of about seven or eight here that you could go for.
Oh, God. Do I get a point for each one?
No, it's you need four.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter who you name. It could be any of them.
Okay, give me a second there. All right.
Okay. Cool. The final question. In light of South London's main transmitting station being in Crystal Palace and having the nickname of South London's Eiffel Tower, can you name two players that have both played for Crystal Palace and PSG? This is supposedly the hardest one.
Right. How does that work as a question?
Well, because we just played Crystal Palace.
Oh, Eiffel Tower. Okay, I see where you're... Crystal Palace and PSG?
Yeah. I'm going to give you leeway if you mention one player that didn't really make any appearances for PSG but was in the first team. He's also currently a Crystal Palace player. That would be my clue for one of them. I'll allow it. But there are also two other Crystal Palace players that you can give that played for them recently.
Oh, God. Oh, this is hard.
Yeah.
Palace and PSG.
Good question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Oh, and one still at Palace.
Well, this one, if you get it, I'm going to give it to you, but it shouldn't really be allowed.
Did he start yesterday?
Yeah, he was in the PSG academy, then he was in the first team, but made no league appearances. I'd like you to get you've got one of them, I can see. I'd like you to get the other proper one, but if you get this other one, then I'm going to allow it, because it's quite a tough question.
Okay. Right.
Okay, cool. So, how many years in a row have Arsenal drawn at home to Palace? Your final answer?
Four.
Three.
Oh!
That's why I tried to give you the Emery clue, because that was the fourth.
So there was this year, last year.
And then the one before that was... And then the one before that was when we lost 3-2. At home when we fucked up top four when Jenkinson and then he started for no reason.
So 2 years ago was the 2-2.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Messed that up.
Besides from Vieira, can you name any four other players to have played for both Milan and Inter?
Zlatan?
Yes.
Crespo?
I need to check that. I didn't have him in my list. Continue and I'll check it afterwards.
Milito?
No, he just played for Inter.
Schneider?
No, just Inter.
Michael?
No, just Inter. Okay. You fucked it anyway. Yeah. I'll give you a list of players. So you could have gone for Seedorf.
Oh.
You could have gone for Ronaldo Nazario.
Oh.
You could have gone for...
Oh.
You could have gone for Andrea Pirlo.
Oh.
You could have gone for Çalhanoğlu, who's just signed for Inter.
Oh, God.
You could have gone for Balotelli. And you also could have gone for Bonucci. I told you, you could have got that.
Yeah, definitely could have got that.
Okay, so I'm not going to give the full question because it's quite long-winded, but two players to have played for Palace and PSG.
Kabay.
Yeah.
Edward.
I'm going to allow it. I mean, I'll allow it because it was a tough question, right. But the correct answer should have been Sacco, the centre-back.
Oh, yeah.
Edward never made any professional appearances for PSG, at least in the league.
Saying that reminds me of that... that video of Sacco spotting Matuidi out on the streets of Paris. That? Yeah. And Matuidi just thinks he's a mental fan. Yeah. I'll see if I can find that to post on our Twitter.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
It's so good. All right, so it's 2-1 to you after this first instalment of... so it's going to be a 3-game 1 this one.
It is, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so lastly for this episode, little Premier League roundup.
Yes.
So we had the opening game on Saturday of Watford-Liverpool.
I watched all of that. Liverpool were just outstanding. However...
Watford did nothing.
Watford, it was one of the worst performances you'll see from a Premier League team. I mean, it kind of masked Liverpool, how good Liverpool were, because then you say, are they really that? Should we get carried away? Or
Because,
I mean, Watford were dreadful. Like, they weren't playing at Premiership level. They were sort of playing a League One sort of standard of football. Yeah.
Salah best in the world right now?
On form, I don't like to say that. I
don't think that anyone can ever be the best in the world right now whilst Messi's still
playing, because he's nowhere near like as gifted as football as Messi, so it just makes it quite hard for me.
I just don't get
on form in terms of impact he's having, goals and assists, it's Salah right now. I just don't like the conversation very much.
And then annoyingly, we had two unbelievable 3 o'clock kickoffs that weren't televised.
Which I watched neither, because I decided to watch Man City because I'm a little Pep Guardiola fan.
Oh, I watched both of them.
Did you? Okay,
yeah, so I had two screens up.
So I tried to do that, but I didn't have enough devices working at once. I tried desperately though. I would have preferred to watch Leicester United, but then I couldn't really be asked for what I thought would have been a typical Leicester outplay United. Ronaldo scores in the 90th minute, or Bruno, or an individual moment of brilliance. Because that just does...
Which
no
it nearly
one
was.
It nearly yeah, was, yeah.
Leicester
it doesn't do anything.
Them, yeah. And then Rashford equalised. But then it was actually really funny. I was watching with one of my mates who's a United fan. And United equalised. And he was like celebrating. And then our stream froze. And the other mate that I was watching with had a bet on 2-2.
Yeah.
So he went to like check the score, and then it said 3-2, and our stream had frozen, and we were all like really confused. Then I've like got it back up, and we've seen Vardy just hammer it into the top corner.
Brilliant.
And he made me turn it off.
Fuming, yeah. No, brilliant.
And then Villa Wolves was just a great game.
Yeah, nobody saw that coming. Yeah. I mean, I think a heap of fortune to Wolves. I mean, all goals were a bit scrappy. The one where Neves plays it to Podence, who squares it, was quite a nice goal, but... The Cody goal and the Neves free kick was scrappy. I mean, it seemed like Villa played quite well for 80 minutes, which was very odd considering they lost.
And then City game...
I watched that. Yeah, they weren't at their normal best. I mean, they controlled the game. They had possession. But they weren't creating... I mean, they still could have won the game 3 or 4-0.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't on their up at home to Burnley in the 12th minute. I sort of expected them to kick on.
Yeah, yeah.
But
fair play to Burnley, who sort of... Stuck it out.
Norwich Brighton,
don't know, didn't watch any, didn't bother watching the highlights.
Southampton Leeds,
didn't watch it either.
Didn't watch, but Leeds are in trouble a little bit.
They are a little bit. They seem to have real squad depth issues where they sort of got these under-23s on the bench that aren't really ready yet.
Mm. And then Brentford Chelsea.
So I was at work for that, and I was sort of monitoring it whenever I could go on my phone.
Oh,
and
Brentford was so unlucky.
I knew as soon as I went on Instagram on my break that I wasn't going to want to watch it on Match of the Day or want to watch the highlights, because I knew it'd be one of those annoying ones where one of our big rivals should have dropped points and they didn't, and then everyone's going to say that's what you need to win a title. But in reality, I have watched the highlights.
Are Chelsea our big rivals anymore?
Well, it doesn't matter where we are on the table. Like,
yeah, I guess.
I despise Chelsea.
Yeah.
After Spurs, true. Chelsea and United, I can't stand them.
Yeah. Mendy was just ridiculous.
Essentially, he saved them. It wasn't even like they defended that well.
No, they didn't defend well at all. I thought Brentford were brilliant.
They were brilliant. They were exceptional.
The sustaining of pressure was just like something I'd not really seen before.
What it does highlight, in my opinion, is that in terms of... I mean, it's subjective, because for me, I like possession-based, high-pressing-based, attacking, creative football, which Chelsea don't give you. They're very... They're the best defensive team in the world, in my opinion, and they can be just as effective in getting results in that fashion than Liverpool and City can. But in terms of suited to what I like from a team, Chelsea are miles behind it compared to Liverpool and City in terms of playing style.
Yeah.
But then again, their playing style can grind out the same standard of results that Liverpool and City can. So it's going to be interesting to see if Chelsea can maintain over 38 games that more defensive counter-attack style, whether it's more suited to a Champions League run.
To a knockout format, and then Sunday we had Everton West Ham, genuinely one of the worst games of football I've ever seen.
Yeah, didn't watch it.
Absolute disaster good pass from Alex Iwobi. He was so bad.
Was he?
He was so bad, it was so funny.
He did his sort of classic sort of step over the ball like 500 times and not really do anything with
it. I'm convinced he doesn't really have any leg power.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever seen him lift the ball higher than like half a metre off the ground.
Fair enough.
He just sort of like swings a little leg,
And then I was having my break on Sunday at work, so I decided to watch the first 5 minutes of Newcastle Spurs, which I enjoyed.
Oh, yeah.
And then about 2 hours later, when I next checked my phone, Spurs won the game, which frustrated me a bit. But I think the most important thing to discuss from that match is obviously the fan collapse, which we're all very glad that
he's that was okay amazing from the
from Reguilon
and Dyer. The quickness of the of the reaction, and then I also was seeing that there was a guy in the crowd that was a doctor that performed CPR straight away. On him.
No, big up to all of them. They did a fantastic job.
Yeah, that was great.
Hope that everything stays okay with that gentleman in the crowd. Touching on Newcastle.
The takeover.
Well, before we touch on the takeover, they're going to go down at this rate.
It would be really funny
if they went down.
But also, I saw some tweet that just said, don't let the takeover disguise the fact that Newcastle still have Joe Linton playing.
Yeah.
Which is actually a real issue.
Yeah, no, it's a massive issue.
I did quite enjoy from the Spurs fans, they were singing "You're Getting Shot in the Morning" to Steve Bruce.
Okay.
Which is quite enjoyable.
Yeah, slightly on edge that,
You know.
But I mean, I really like Newcastle as a club. I've been to St James's Park and I've spent a weekend up there, and it's a fantastic place. It's a real footballing. It's a one city club, so it's a big club. So I was on one hand, I'm quite happy about the takeover, but then on the other hand, not from the people that are taking them over, the human rights issues and whatnot.
Yeah.
It leaves a really sour taste in your mouth, and it's going to probably make me dislike Newcastle.
Yeah.
Well, whereas I quite liked them before, but. Yeah.
I mean, we'll see how that
they
goes.
They play dire football. At this rate, they're going down unless they sign a fuckload of players in January.
Yeah. John Joe Shelby's cameo was quite good.
Oh, that's smart from him.
Yeah.
Genius player. I mean, who was it? Matt Ritchie that said that he could play for Barcelona. He has got a good passing range, but nothing else.
That's the sentence I never thought I'd hear anyone say.
In my life, yeah.
Matt Ritchie said that John Joe Shelby could play for Barcelona.
He did, it's not, promise you.
Yeah, I know. It's just like.
It's crazy.
Who's Matt Ritchie to say?
Who is Matt Ritchie to say?
Right, so that's it for today's episode. Disappointing result. And, yeah, I mean, what else is there to say?
Onwards and upwards, Villa on Friday. I don't know. I mean, it was a must-win before this result, and it's still a must-win.
Now there's a lot more pressure.
I think it's a must-win plus good performance now if you want to add an extra dimension to it.
Yeah, so we'll see you for that one. Villa and then Leicester.
Two tough games, but we're going to need 6 points from them now. We'll drop points against Palace.
Yeah. So, see you next week.
Take care.